following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704 Houser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
Well, this is going to be all of the above. That's how it's listed. Norman Lear, all of the above with Norman Lear. I'm that chap. Sitting to my right is Paul Hipp, my partner here in this podcast.
Hello, Norman.
At Podcast One. If you heard Hello, Norman, you heard Paul Hipp.
Yes.
And so we're expecting one of the more interesting people on the face of the planet.
Yeah, this is going to be a good show.
I frankly don't know anybody quite like him, and I know somebody quite like you. I know a lot of people quite like me. I don't know.
Our guest today is a true original.
We're all true. We are individuals and originals. But he's coming in now, and
hey.
It's Ru Paul himself. Come on in, Rue.
Hi, Rue.
Hi.
Putting on his headset, sitting across the table, is this very good-looking chap.
Oh, I didn't think you noticed.
Yes, I've noticed. And it's Ru Paul.
Real name Ru Paul.
P-A-U-L.
That's right. But it's my first name. You know that. My first name is RuPaul. My last name is Charles. And you know,
Charles.
Yeah. In New York, people call me Rapool.
Rapool.
Yeah. Rapool.
Uh-huh.
And then in black folks in the South call me Ruth Paul.
Ruth Paul.
Ruth Paul.
Are you black?
I'm several many things. Several many things. I'll answer to pretty much anything.
The expression of expressions your answer to is drag queen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do I remember correctly that when I was growing up, or at 95, I have a lot of years to look at, speaking of growing up. But at one point, was that a nasty expression?
I think it's all about the intent behind the words. You can't legislate intent. People try to legislate words, that you can't say this, you can say this. It depends on the intent behind every word that is spoken. If it's mm-hmm. coming from a place of love, or if it's coming from a place of fear or hatred, So I love words. And I love lots of words that are considered naughty words. But what the listener must do is go into your own personal GPS system and go, where is the intent mm-hmm. by the person speaking that word? Mm. So I'm sure you could use any word to mean something nasty. You know what I mean? Any word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ooh. Well, was it conceived? Well, on which side of the equation was it conceived?
The word drag queen?
Yeah. By queens or by people who were describing them?
No, I'm sure by queens. I heard years ago that it was the word drag comes from Shakespeare, where it would say dressed as girl, mm-hmm. where they would describe a character dressed as girl. I don't know if that's true. That's what people say. But, drag queen was definitely conceived as by queens as a... something that's not derogatory,
mm-hmm.
Dressed
as girl. Had you ever heard that?
Well, no, but I do love that you said that we were all born naked, The rest is just drag.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. That's
such
it.
A great quote.
Yeah, you know, if you've been on the planet long enough, you realize all of this flesh, all of this stuff that we are, you know, that we consider material worth, you know, it's just stuff. It all passes along. And, you know, I like to use all the colors in the crayon box. So, you know, clothes, cars, all the stuff. I want to play with everything. I like it. I like the stuff.
So as I said, but before you were here, before you came in the door, that you are a true original. And we were discussing that we are all originals. Of course, we're all originals. Mm-hmm. But we start out, we're all originals. But it's that thing of playing with all the colors in the crayon box.
Yeah.
You know, some are more original than others after that.
Yeah.
There's a bravery to that. There's also a self-awareness that you always have seemed to have had.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
You know, I think you're absolutely right. We all start with it, but I think people succumb to fear very easily.
Mm.
It becomes very easy to just sort of play along with what society wants you to do, because society wants you to be in a box that they can understand. They can go, oh, I get what you are, you know. But if you don't allow them to do that, they become very threatened by you. And it takes a lot of courage to be able to walk down the street and live with the fact that you may be threatening to other people.
Yeah.
But you know what? I say, if they ain't paying your bills, you pay them bitches no mind. That's what Mama used to say. That's what Mama said.
So is your mom a source of that strength of individuality for you?
Yes. My mother since has gone on to Paris, as did my father. They've gone on to Paris. But
when you say Paris, do you mean they passed on?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
I love going on to Paris.
They moved on to Paris. My mother was punk rock. My mother was She knew the Bible backwards and forwards, but she was completely against organized religion. She said they were all crooks and they were all liars, and you know. But she could quote the Bible, and she was very religious. She was the kind of person who questioned authority and who was not just going to do things because and play nice because it made other people feel comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah.
How conventionally educated was she?
I think she may have gone after high school to a vocational school for secretaries or something like that. But not very. I think this was just intrinsically who she was. She was always an outsider and always someone who actually, years ago, I saw a psychic who said that my mother was world weary, and that really does describe her. She didn't like it on this planet. She didn't like it at all. And you know, it's interesting because my role as a kid, I felt it was my role to sort of cheer her up. She says, "Oh, you don't have any happiness? Let me give you some of mine." You know, and that's where the built-in entertainer in me came. I thought, "Oh, I can do this. I can make you understand why this life is worth living." You know, and of course we now know.
So, how can you recall anything at the youngest age? I love that, and you could have started that at age six.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, without understanding what you were doing, you were there to entertain her and make her understand that the world was a joyful place.
Yes. Isn't that funny? Because I do think we come here with an agenda. Each person comes here with an agenda that they want to project or that they want to see come to fruition. Some people are blocked and some people don't have the courage to follow through on that. Actually, when my mother was pregnant with me, she saw a psychic who said, "Oh, this is going to be a boy." Of course, this is before ultrasound. "It's going to be a boy and he's going to be famous." And that's why she says she named me RuPaul, because ain't another MF on the planet with a name like that, and he's going to be famous. So I grew up with her telling me, "Well, you know, you're going to be famous," you know. And so part of it was just who I am, and part of it was I was told that, you know.
At what age did you feel your sexuality?
I think probably around 8 years old? The kids in the neighborhood told me I was a sissy before I was thinking about sexuality. You know, people, the kids in the neighborhood would say, oh, you're a sissy. And I said, okay, all right, whatever that means or what that, you know. But I wasn't thinking about sex. But I guess I probably had my first crush on someone probably at 8 years old, probably, something like that. Probably, you know, if I really got down to it, my first crush would probably have been my father, who even at a young age I realized I looked exactly like him. And it was a strange – I remember it was a strange happening, occurrence of looking at someone and thinking, wow, we look alike. Now, it took many years later, like 40 years later, for him to say, you know, we look alike. I'm like, duh.
As you continued to grow, you looked more like him?
Absolutely. But he was someone who was – completely shut down. He could not experience life on life's terms. He was someone who, I felt I'd shared past lives with him, and I felt, you want some joy? You want some pain? Let me remind you of who you really are. But he could not. He could not accept that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you always been aware of that? That sort of. Sleepwalking through life thing that some people do, because I know some of the on your show, the kids, that you give a lot of great philosophical, spiritual advice and advice of eyes opening your eyes to everything. Has that been something that you were always keyed into?
Always, yeah. Always. It's like the emperor has no clothes. I was always aware that could see through always aware of the fourth wall, and you know. I was always looking for other people to go, are you guys seeing that the emperor is not wearing any clothes? And I couldn't find other people to go along with it. Everybody was playing along with the facade of life as a play. And then I remember when I saw Monty Python on PBS.
Oh, wow.
Monty Python's Flying Circus on PBS. I thought, there they are. There's my tribe. They get it. My people are there. And I knew I wasn't alone. I knew that my job was to go and find my tribe.
And where did that lead you to, New York City?
Well, that led me to musical theater, darling.
Oh, I should say
to the arts, darling. Which is, you know, the place where you can talk about the life's great hoax and the illusion of life, and people won't look at you crazy, you know, because life is a play.
What was the first musical or semi-musical that you did?
Well, let's see. I think, I went to the San Diego Children's Theater, and I'm trying to remember what the first thing I did. It was something very, very common. I don't even remember what it was. But I went on from there to Atlanta, Georgia, and I was in a high school for performing arts, and the first play I did there was 1976. It was Tennessee Williams' Camino Real.
Ooh,
yeah, little known. I don't know if it's very famous.
Yeah.
It's famous known, among people who know his work.
Yeah. And actually in that play I was in drag in that play, and I had no idea when I did that drag would end up being my vehicle in this life.
Is there Camino Real? I'm trying. Did Marlon Brando play?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Did he play Kilroy? Was that the name? No.
That was the show in which he, what was her name, the lead actress's character?
I can't remember.
Because he called it out.
That's Streetcar.
Stella. Yeah.
But he was in Camino Real also, I believe.
I believe too.
Yeah.
Do you know, for Halloween, did you go out and try? Can I just say that? 3 or 4 years in a row, I went Halloween in drag.
And did you, the next morning, did you have blood in your panties?
I did, just in the back.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I had, let me tell you.
And you had a good time.
I had a lot of candy. I had way more candy than my brother. He went as Spider-Man. He didn't get nearly as much candy as me.
Now, because we're talking to a big, broad audience.
Yeah, I just opened up about that.
Yeah.
I'm being honest here.
But talk about what you were saying. Describe what you were talking about. Because
well, what I was going to say, when did you discover that? And what did that feel like? Was it in the play, Camino Real?
No. Even as a young age, I used all the colors in the crayon box. I always thought of it as drag. I always saw myself as the little boy who fell to earth and that everyone's, that I'm playing along, I'm pretending to be human. And I want to be here on this planet and use and touch everything and use all the colors and play with everything. And I thought it was strange that people would say, oh, these clothes belong to boys,
yeah,
and these clothes, yeah, belong to girls, and you people can say these words, and you people can drink out of this water fountain, and you people, this soul separation thing. I thought, that is the craziest thing I've ever heard. So drag, I've always thought of everything I wear is drag. That's where You're Born Naked and the Rest is Drag,
yeah,
comes from. And by the way, I've always hated Halloween. Love the candy, hate the concept of one day a year
we get to dress up.
Just one day?
Yeah.
I thought, you know what? That will be the day I do not dress up. I'll dress up every day except for Halloween.
That's why I'm fascinated by the bravery that you had as a kid. Where does that come from? I was a Bowie fanatic.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, you talk about 1976, Station to Station Tour. Uh-huh. I think of years in the 70s in Bowie albums. And I,
yeah,
had all these photographs on the wall everywhere of, yeah, Bowie, who could just... And I've also heard you talk about being willing to die and be reborn.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
in who you are.
Well, he's already done that a number of times.
And
sure.
I just love that.
I just did it in the waiting room before I walked in here. I died, and I was reborn again. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. No, Bowie was a big thing for me. Two nights ago, I still have an iTunes library, believe it or not. Two nights ago, I spent 2 hours rearranging my David Bowie playlist.
Oh, I love it. Because I'm still sitting Shiva.
Me too. I absolutely am. I love him so much.
We lost Bowie a couple of years ago.
Yes, neither of these guys, the one Jew in the room, wouldn't say sitting Shiva because he wanted everybody to understand what the hell he was talking about.
Well, I was.
So it took a guy to do it.
Well, the thing is, you guys have some great words that we just don't have, and so I just decided to steal them.
No,
because why should your words? Why
sitting
should those
is,
like the clothes?
Sitting Shiva is what Jewish and others, it seems, yeah, do in recognition of somebody's passing.
Jews and lapsed Catholics.
They spend some evenings, some days, and nights, depending on how much time they have, just sitting in memory of the person who passed.
Yes.
And that's called sitting Shiva.
Yes, yes. But I think, honestly, I think everybody knows that, you know, because I grew up watching television it was written by Borscht Belt Comics, your television shows, where I was introduced to Jewish traditions just sort of vicariously, and they've become part of the national vernacular, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting. In fact, because of Norman's shows, you know, there are rhythmic jokes that even if they're not funny, I will laugh at it because I've been programmed to, if the rhythm goes da 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 da, and I go because I've been programmed that way. And it's interesting how much Yiddish I know based on the television shows that I grew up watching.
Yeah,
you know.
Well, how about those of us, you know, whiteys, who have learned everything we know about entertainment, about dance. You know, I'm rethinking that as I say it. And we, my God, how much we've learned from black people.
Yeah.
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 And I've often, I don't know whether I've said it in the podcast, but having visited any number of times black congregations on,
mm-hmm,
a Sunday,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and reacted with them and sat among them as they carried on and so forth.
Yeah.
I've often thought, as I sat in a white church or a synagogue, that if those black people were called living, alive, you got to find another word for us.
Yeah, right.
Because it just isn't the same experience.
Well, it's not the same experience. But, you know, I this goes back to what we were talking about earlier of using all the colors in the crayon box. We as people on this planet have more in common than we don't have in common, if that makes any sense. I think that it's important to recognize those places where we are alike, you know. And it's interesting, you know, when the struggles in this country, how blacks and gays and Jews and women, a lot of the struggles are so similar. You would think that these groups would bond together and sort of forge a new way of thinking, a new way of thinking that actually is a way to move the conversation forward and to include more people, you know? It's a very interesting thing. I'm always surprised how unevolved our humans on this planet still are. Yeah. Technologically, we've done all these fabulous things, but emotionally, we're still stuck in the dark ages. And let me tell you something. If this electrical grid went out here in Los Angeles, California, you'd see how primitive our culture really is.
Oh, yeah.
In a matter of probably in hours, you'd see how primitive we are.
Yeah. I've often thought that, too. Mm. You also see how kind we are, how to speak, who would help who would be about surviving, you know, what would be the dominant force there?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what I mean? Would it be just like, okay, I'm on my own, or I'm with my tribe, or would it be let's come together? Right now.
Yeah. Well.
Me.
Yeah. Well. I'm afraid, especially here in Los Angeles. I'm afraid it would probably be every man for himself.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Well, what happened during the blackout in New York City?
Which one? Is 78? 77? 78?
Yeah. Well, there was some looting.
Yeah.
But didn't people?
Were you there,
come
Norman?
Together?
For that?
I wasn't there. No, I was here. I'm having a difficult time remembering that blackout.
Speaking of New York and Bowie, his influence on you, because you seem to have picked up clearly and run with that whole thing of mm-hmm. that just individuality mm-hmm. and unapologetically, this is who I am mm-hmm. and do your thing. And also one of the things that I went to Wigstock one year.
What year?
Which I was there, geez, this would have been 19, a while ago, 19, I want to say 90. Eight or so.
Huh.
It got dressed, went shopping on 14th Street,
uh-huh.
and went. That got. I mean, got fully dressed up.
Where was Wigstock?
Well, okay, Wigstock used to be. It started out in the East Village. And correct me if I'm wrong. It was a little thing with drag queens. It grew into this gigantic thing. It was on the West Side Highway when I went,
yeah.
and the whole city came out, and families, and drag queens everywhere, and then people like me that are drag queens, but got into the spirit of the thing, and got in drag, and went down, and it was like almost like some sort of, like a dream come true, where the families and the freaks yeah. and all the people came together and celebrated. And I've always thought that came from, in a large part, you and what you spearheaded.
Well, what Wigstock was created by Lady Bunny, who was a friend of mine from Atlanta from 1982. In fact, when the first time Lady Bunny got into drag, I put her into drag.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So she, on one drunken morning after clubbing, having not slept, her and some other kids went over to from the Pyramid Club over to Tompkins Square Park. This was 1985.
Tompkins Square Park.
And they put on a show, and they thought, well, we should do one of these every year. So that was the birth of Wigstock. And it's, of course, a play on Woodstock. Same kind of feeling, but done with synthetic wigs. And so that grew and grew and grew. And then at one point, they stopped it. And then it came back in 95, and then it came back a few other times on the West Side Highway, which is probably where you went to.
It might have been 95 that I was there.
Yeah, and it's a great thing. In fact, we've carried that tradition on to with our show and with a convention we do every year called RuPaul's Drag Con, which is going to happen May 11th, 12th, and 13th here in Los Angeles. And then I believe it's in September at the Jacob Javits Center in New York. So we and that spirit of young people who are 10, 11, 12 who don't go to clubs, and their parents who are open-minded,
yeah,
they get to come together and just celebrate. And what, you know what it is? It's the promise of what the 60s and 70s sort of preached, which is this concept of openness and of playing with all the colors in the crayon box and not taking life too friggin' seriously. Yeah. Everybody takes themselves so seriously, you know? And you know, putting on a synthetic wig is your way of saying to God, hey, I get the joke and I'm in on it. Let's party.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Because most people, you know, the Auntie Mame, you know, life's a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death. I'm not gonna starve in this lifetime. This life is too much of a gift for me to poo-poo and turn my nose back and say, well, we do, in my family, we only tweed and 100% cotton, darling. You know, I'm going to have some fun. I'm going to...
I love what you said a little while ago when you talked about hating Halloween because it was the one day that was set aside for dressing as you want, as crazily as you wish, as insanely as you wish, or not.
Yeah.
And you feel that way about 365 days.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a sensational attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. This life is a gift. And it's, you know, yes, life is short, but life is also long. Life is also very long. So you might as well get into it.
You're looking at a 95-year-old as you say that.
Yes. Yes. You might as well get into it and do something. Let somebody love you and, you know, love somebody back. Because ultimately, when you leave this whole thing, that's all you will remember from the experience. Did you love somebody? Did you allow people to love you back?
Mm. Do you expect to see anybody when you pass?
I you know what?
Your mom, are you going to see her again?
You know what? This is the thing. She's with me. Physically, not. I saw that kid, the Hollywood medium, Tyler Henry.
Right. Yeah.
And he is a medium. And when I met with him, my mother came through. And I knew it was her energy. I don't need to know exactly how it works. I don't need to know what God is. I don't need to know that God is a thing. All I need to know is that there is something.
Mm-hmm.
There is something. I don't need to explain it. It's like having a computer that hasn't been updated to the latest operating system, and it or trying to have a PC communicate with an Apple computer. It's like they don't. And that's how my brain is. So there are things I will never understand, and I'm okay with that. My point, though, is that my mother, the energy that she was or is, still lives in me. It still vibrates in me. My father, too. Everything I've ever done, every television show I've ever seen, every song I've ever sung, it's inside of me.
You are a composite of every minute you spent on the planet, of course.
Yeah, so it's there. It's there. She's there. They're all there. The grandmothers and the grandfathers.
They're all there.
You know, they're all there.
Do you think you'll see someone, Norman, when you get...
You know, I think one of the most exciting things about... It's hard to be a human being.
Yes.
It's easier to talk about that attitude towards life. Every day it's a joy. But it's possible to find it and live it. What was your question?
Do you think you'll see somebody on the other side? Like
one of the most fascinating things and I think enjoyable things about it all is, with all the complexity in the world and all of what mankind has managed to understand about life, the sciences, everything we've accomplished, there is no sense of what follows.
Mm-hmm.
None. Mm-hmm. Nobody has come back. Nobody has. There is no sense of what is. Do we go on? Is it a long sleep, a forever sleep? Nobody knows. I love that nobody knows. Yeah. I mean, I think that's great that there is absolutely no way to know.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry, but there's no way for the ego to know. I think somehow in a different consciousness, in your body, in your spirit, somewhere, there is an acknowledgement of there's something else. Now, the ego, there's no answer to that question that would satisfy the ego mind. Because when we are afraid of dying, it's the ego that is afraid of dying. We intrinsically know that there is a cutoff time for this flesh and bone that we are. We know that. We know that from the day we're born. And I think there is a part of our consciousness that knows that there is something else. We don't know what it is. We don't have the vernacular to explain what. We don't have to know what it is. Mm. But I think it boils down to the ego. I think the ego is the one that is so afraid of dying and so perplexed by what the concept of death is.
Yeah, because in not knowing, and I think I'm hearing both of you say the same thing, and I agree, celebrate it. Mm-hmm. I celebrate not knowing.
No, what RuPaul is saying, or did they call you Ru without the ball?
You can call me anything you want. Yes, call me Ru.
What the son of a bitch is
saying. Uh-huh, exactly.
Is that something follows.
Yeah.
I'm saying is there's no evidence that
right.
anything follows. Maybe it does.
Right.
I'm perfectly willing to believe it, but...
But what I'm saying is we all celebrate that fact.
That there is
that
something
we don't
else.
Know.
That we don't know.
That
yeah.
we don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
The ego wants to know. The ego.
No, but he knows something. Something follows. He believes something.
He believes
follows.
That better than knows.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do with what the ego's idea of what something is. Like there's
I
a
see.
Consciousness and we speak to people and say, I believe in energy. I believe that energy does not die. And I believe that it vibrates at different levels. And that we are that thing. But does it then put sentences together and go, oh, you're my mother and you're my father? The truth is, we're not separate from one another. We are one thing. And it looks, our perception says, oh, you're on that side of the table and I'm over here. But the truth is, we're not separate from one another. We are one thing. And that one thing we are continues on. Like, now, the brain is trying to wrap itself around, okay, how does that work? The brain will never figure that out. You will know in your gut that is real.
Mm. So in a sense, you're saying there's one brain and we share it.
And not a brain. There's a one consciousness.
Consciousness. Business.
Yeah, there's more consciousness than what the mind is. There's mm-hmm. there's a bigger consciousness.
And we all have a paddle in that water.
Absolutely.
I love I heard from a meditation teacher, where does my consciousness end and yours begin? Where does consciousness end and where does it begin?
Yeah, and where do farts go?
Farts go to the fart zone. Didn't you ever hear Steve Martin sing? They go to the fart zone, which is just above the ozone layer. So that's why they're so worried about the ozone layers, because if it disintegrates, the fart zone will come back to Earth.
I see. Well, there, that makes sense.
And he also adds that they will not fall on their original owners. Thank you, Steve Martin.
It's the first time I've ever thought about owning your farts.
Yeah, right.
Oh, well, nobody's better. You know, when you walk, when you don't know who did it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, mine, you know.
Yeah.
But not yours.
Well, we know yours.
Well, yeah. No, you don't know mine yet. Wait, hold on a second. Let me see if I can
God
work
does.
Something up. Give me a minute. Oh,
well,
winner.
So we've solved the mystery of where we go after death.
Where our farts go.
Where farts go. We probably all go to that very same place. So next on the agenda is
where did my dog go?
Where have you been so far?
Where have I been?
And
so
you've
far?
Been into a number of things that a lot of our audience know about. Talk about some of that.
Well,
the films you've made.
Well, the main thing is that, you know, I started out in, I climbed up on stage and got money for it the first time in 82. That was the first time I was actually paid for it. And I was always a show off and performing in children's theater and all that kind of stuff. But 82 when I started my career.
I was 60 years old.
In 82, you were 60.
When you were 82. In 82, I was 60.
In 60, yeah.
I was 1 year out of high school.
Really? Wow,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, classic.
And, you know, ever since then, I've been at it. I've been doing, and it took about 11 years for me to sort of hit the big time. And that was with a record called Supermodel, You Better Work. And I was in music videos on MTV, and that led to a makeup contract with MAC Cosmetics. And that led to a television show after the talk show on VH1. After that, I took some time away from show business. I was turning 40. This is 2000. I was turning 40, quit drinking, quit doing drugs, and had barbecues, got to know my nieces and nephews, stepped away from the canvas, so to speak. Mm. And then in 04, I came back to it. I was doing a morning drive radio show in New York. Made a low-budget movie, and my friends from the East Village, who I've been working with since 85, something like that, they said, so you're serious about coming back? I said, yes. Well, let's take out a reality show, because I'd been against doing a reality show for many years because I didn't want to do anything mean-spirited. And so they said, yes, let's do something that's lovely. We pitched it out, and when we got to Logo Network, they pretty much bought the pitch in the room. And so ever since then, that was 10 years ago, we've been doing the show called RuPaul's Drag Race, which has led to other things. But that's the thing that I sort of really, it's my legacy now. It's the thing that I will be remembered for. So that's what I've been doing in these years.
But I did your podcast, so you've been doing a podcast also.
I'm
making records.
I'm old school show business. I will do whatever job I could do. I make records, I write, I produce, executive produce a TV show, design clothes. I've got a pop-up shop. We do this RuPaul's DragCon, which is a convention. You name it. That's where I come from in the business.
Where's DragCon at?
Here in Los Angeles, it will be May 11th, 12th, and 13th at the LA Convention Center. And this is the funny thing. With our TV show, Drag Race, a lot of kids around the world fall in love with this show, and they communicate with each other on social media, but they don't meet. So we thought, wouldn't it be fabulous if we could put together an event where all of these young people can come together and meet their tribe? And what's funny, and we didn't expect this, is that the audience were mostly 11, 12, 13-year-old kids who don't identify as drag or gay or anything. These kids are the future. They're forward-thinking kids who have none of the craziness surrounding, ooh, she's a boy, none of that. And their parents who grew up watching Norman Lear show, or maybe their grandparents who grew up watching Norman Lear TV shows and the promise of an open society, are taking these kids to this convention. And it, you know, something that years ago would have been considered subversive is now a celebration of textures and colors and freedom, especially given the political climate we're in right now. So that's coming up Mother's Day weekend of this year, May 11th, 12th, 13th.
Businesses, I assume, support it.
Yes. Well, what happens is people buy booths and makeup companies, and they all come together, and the drag queens come, and we take pictures with the fans, and it's their events, and there's a big runway where the kids get to take their picture on the runway. In fact, this year, we're bringing the workroom from our television show into the convention center, so the audience can come and play around in the workroom they've come to know from our television show, bring part of the set into the thing. And then I'm there, and I do the keynote address at the end of every one of them. It's really fabulous. It really is.
That's great. Have you ever been a drag?
Would you make a note of that date? I'm asking somebody who comes with me.
Yes.
To, make a note of that date because I want to visit that.
Good.
Yeah, me too.
We can do it together.
Yeah, that sounds like the promise of Wigstock happening.
Absolutely.
I just love the inclusion of it all. And inclusion is the key.
Absolutely. You know, and I just want to go back to the Norman Lear television shows just for a second, because there was a mentality of vernacular that these shows all had that really spoke to what the possibilities of humans on this planet, the possibilities of being able to understand your neighbor as your brother, as your sister, as yourself. And this is, and somehow we got disconnected from that, from the 70s, and then here we are in the whatever they call this. Somehow we got disconnected. I think our show, Drag Race, somehow represents the promise of the Norman Lear shows in today's vernacular, today's world. Mm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, totally. Empathy, understanding. How did you know? I mean, how are you so far ahead of your time, even to have like Edith's friend, who's killed in the show, on the family, right?
What was her name again?
I can't remember.
I can't remember her name.
She was a drag queen from San Francisco.
Queen.
Yeah, and you were dealing with that in the 70s,
and she was well known. She was
it Jim? Was it Jim Bailey? Jim Bailey? Was that
no?
I can't remember. No. The kids at maybe in the booth, they're looking it up in the booth.
What could happen that would cause Edith to lose her faith in God? And the only thing we could think of, and it took a little while, like weeks, was we had done a show with a drag queen was in the back of a cab. Archie had a second job. He was driving a cab. There was a drag queen in the back of the cab who had a heart attack. He gave him, or her rather, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Mm-hmm. She found out who was driving the cab and where he lived, and she came to the house and knocked on the door and to thank the man who saved her life. Archie's upstairs. Edith, greets her, and Edith learns that she's a drag queen. And the way she takes it is just we always asked ourselves, how would Edith react to anything? And the answer was, to everything, was the way Jesus might. Love. Turn everything with love. So Archie came downstairs and he learns that the individual that he had given mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to was not a woman, was a man. So we did the whole thing because that would be a great joke for Archie. That would be just a great moment for Archie. But we all fell in love with the performer, Beverly LaSalle.
Yes.
Then we wondered three years later, how would she lose her faith in God? And we came up with the notion that Beverly LaSalle was killed for being who she was. And Edith could believe in a God that could see that happen.
Yeah.
We had that, but we couldn't do the show until we knew how she regained her faith because Edith had to have her faith. We couldn't write a faithless Edith. And so it was months. And I remember bringing in from the philosophy department at UCLA, some strangers who were deep into philosophy and religion and so forth, talking about how would she regain her faith. It was a long time before somebody asked this simple question. By the way, when Edith loses her faith, what happens to Archie? And we had the second episode. Edith, a faithless Edith, is not the strong woman that Archie depended on. On every level. And so she had to regain it when she realized that Archie had no.
Right.
that's how we found.
Yeah.
Him.
Wow. Wow.
So
months
great.
Later. Wow. Months later. Those were two maybe my favorite episodes.
Oh, God.
Really, great. Really amazing. Especially when I, as you were saying, I was thinking about the Pollyanna character in and how the Pollyanna character is not unaware. She's aware of the darkness, but she chooses to see the light. Mm. And as you were describing this, and I'm thinking about Edith Bunker, she was a Pollyanna. She understood that there was darkness.
Yeah.
But she focused on the light. And in fact, years ago, in a dream, I knew Tammy Faye Baker very well. I narrated her documentary called The Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Yeah.
And after she passed, she appeared in a dream of mine, and she said, "Rue, focus on a person's innocence, not on their guilt." And it was clear as day in this dream. Focus on a person's innocence, not their guilt. And that was her to a T. That she, listen, I think she understood what her husband was doing and all that. But she also knew that in the bigger picture, they were actually helping a lot of people who needed.
But was she always like that? Because that suggests non-judgmental to me. And in my mind, and I could be wrong about this, that's the ultimate in judgment.
Is people being non-judgmental?
No, to be non-judgmental, Jim Baker and Tammy Faye and those fire and brimstone people, mm-hmm. or do I have them wrong? Were they never that? Was there a redemption in that sense that she came to that?
No, I think that she always understood that there was a darkness to the thing that they were doing.
Yeah.
I think she understood that. But I think that overall she allowed it to happen so that the light could shine through.
Hmm.
That's what I think, you know.
Yeah.
But did she come around to that? I think she was always that way. I think that there was always a cult following of the show, even if people who were not their religion.
And a tremendous amount of money raised.
Oh, yes.
Because they had a community, a city they owned.
Yeah, it was Heritage USA.
Yes, Heritage, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And it was because did you do a TV show on something based on that? No. I'm thinking of Fernwood USA.
Fernwood Tonight.
Oh,
yeah.
That was a great one.
Yeah. But anyway, this concept of a Pollyanna understanding both sides of what this world is. There's yin, there's yang, there's black and white. And there's an in-between all there, too. But I see Edith Bunker as that type of a character who she understood that Archie had his crunchy bits.
Yeah, yeah.
But she chose to see the vulnerability of him, and no one knew it more than she did.
Did she have to work to stay?
I remember this little bit of conversation. I don't know. Maybe it was rehearsal for the very first episode, or maybe it was the third episode or something. But early on, Gene Stapleton asked me, Norman, when Archie's carrying on, when he rants, one of those, saying all those things that I can't bear, what am I thinking? And I said, you're the middle sister of the Anders. and you're singing Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree.
Uh-huh.
I love that.
Yeah. It's funny, my husband is Australian, and a lot of times and he could be very crude at times. And it's kind of a cultural thing,
Italian, did you say?
No, he's Australian.
Oh, Australian.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
And so sometimes I'll bring it upon myself to explain to bystanders, he's Australian, so it's not meant to be offensive.
Right,
I mean, it's not meant to be hurtful. It's just it can come across as a little crude from time to time. So I'll say, you have to excuse me. He's Australian.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. But I love that. I my tribe of people love the irreverent. In fact, I explain it like this. When you're a sweet, sensitive soul on this planet, there are many different sort of levels and levels of understanding and of consciousness. When you're a kid, you realize that this world is a hoax and that you've been hoaxed into believing that all of this is really real. Mm. And then when you uncover that hoax, you become angry. You become angry and bitter and cynical. But it's important to not stay in that stage of recognition. You have to move beyond the cynicism and the bitterness to the next level, which is the most important level, which is have fun with it. Don't take it too seriously.
Yeah.
Laugh at it. Laugh with it. Yes, it's a hoax. It's a hoax. Life is a hoax and an illusion. And yes, get mad and get cynical and get bitter. But then the next level, the most important one is, now laugh with it. Don't take it too seriously.
What's amazing is people stay in that other place. They never get – it's because – and been there.
Yes.
It is uncomfortable. It's a miserable place. I mean, between here and here, I'm pointing to my ears.
Yes, yes.
Between here and here, it's a nightmare. And at a certain point, I don't understand why you – it takes work to get past it, but boy, oh boy, is it more comfortable to lose all of that and try and live in a more positive space and to not take things so seriously.
Well, but
and to see the good in others, because that allows you to be more non-judgmental, which allows you to not fall down that misery trap.
Yeah, but the thing is, you have to also understand that there is a payoff in staying in that bitterness. Because when you stay in the bitterness, and listen, I've been guilty of it myself. I could be guilty of it probably in traffic when I'm leaving here today.
Yeah.
It gives you a carte blanche to complain. It gives you the payoff is it allows you to complain about life. You know,
and all your questions are answered because they're the idiot.
Yeah,
and you're good.
Yeah, F you and
lane.
But talk about complaining about life. You call it a hoax.
Yes. Well, it is a hoax.
Explain that.
What we've been sold, this idea of what this material world is, I call it a hoax because it's like a play. It's like we're all playing these characters. And I have 2.5 children and a wife and a garage and a car, and we are Presbyterian and my life, you know, all of this stuff. When you look below the surface, and by the way, not too deep below the surface, you realize everybody has a secret life, a secret self, a self and a subconscious mind that is actually really calling the shots, and that the man behind the curtain is actually really pulling the strings. It's just like The Wizard of Oz, where you have this concept of what's right with the world and what is good, and then upon closer examination, you realize it's like in the Matrix. I always use movie references where we're actually in these pods, and our every original idea we've ever come up with has been programmed into our head. Mm. And once you unplug that, and usually I've discovered a lot of this through hallucinogenics, I have to say this. That's a little disclaimer. what you realize is that there is another world, a true world of who we really are. And that's – I get really angry about that. But then actually that's when the party really begins. When you uncover what is really real, the party can begin because you think, oh, no, I'm not confined by – what it says I am on my birth certificate or what it says I am on my driver's license. I am whatever I want to be. Then the party can begin. So, you know, it's important to move beyond the bitterness of that discovery into the place of, it's a hoax. Then I can be a hoaxer too. Have fun with it. And that's what I realized when I found Monty Python's Flying Circus. They were in on the joke. They said, none of it is serious. This life, nothing serious. The only thing you should consider and hold dear is the love you give and the love you allow yourself to receive. Mm. That's the basis.
I love hearing all that, and believe I understand it. The metaphor that I've enjoyed using that says some of that, not all of it, is, do you know burlesque?
the genre of burlesque?
The genre of burlesque.
Yeah.
The comedian and the straight man.
Yes.
I mean, the straight man and the comic.
Yes.
And the stripper. The strippers were never sexy. They were funny. You know, it can't be anything but funny if it takes a minute and a half to roll a sleeve down. But I think often, you know, the straight man knew everything. He knew everything.
Mm-hmm.
And in the course of expressing everything, he had the comic running into walls.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
So I think that of leadership in our country, in our world today, you know, they're the straight men.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know a fucking thing, but they know everything.
Right.
And they have all of us bumping into walls.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit of what you're talking about,
sure.
too.
Yeah, it is. Because the straight man, the comic, and the straight man, the comic, and the burlesque dancer, they represent the mind, body, and spirit. They're the holy trinity. And so they represent every aspect of consciousness that we that we are on this planet. The stripper is the folly, the fun of life, the joy of life, of not taking either the straight man or the comic seriously. She lands somewhere in the middle, enjoying the process of living, enjoying her body. She's enjoying her body. She is the dancer. And we are all three. Each of us represents all three. And that's why a balance in life, an equilibrium, is our desired position, where we can be all three at once.
Mm.
The straight man, the comic, and the dancer who can dance in between both. I just came up with this stuff, by the way.
This is right off the top of your head. I mean, come on. Where do I sign up for this church? I believe.
You know what's funny is I'm actually, you know, I'm always working, trying to work this out because I'm still trying to figure out what this is. I have an idea of what this life is. I do know, don't take it too effing seriously.
Yeah.
Emphasis on the two. Don't take it too seriously. But as I live, I have to reiterate, I have to remind myself, sort of pinch myself like a totem, a reminder in my hand to say, Rue, remember, this is a dream. Don't take it too seriously. Have fun. Yeah. Dance.
But everything you're talking about, everything you're expressing is the thinking and philosophy of a serious mind.
Absolutely.
Well, you know,
a seer, a seeker of things.
Yeah. Well, I guess I didn't come up with this stuff. In fact, you know, I grew up in the 70s and reading all the self-help books and stuff. And all of these ideas are things that I learned from that stuff. And I know
you've made it entirely your own. It's very original.
Yeah. I'm still trying to figure it out. Or not figure it out and just be the dancer and dance and have fun. And by the way, laughing and dancing are my two favorite things to do on this planet.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wish there were more discos to go to. I say more. I wish there was one disco to go to.
Are there no more discos?
The
live music clubs are dying. Discos are... What do people do? They stay home and look at their computers.
I think it's indicative of where we are today.
Yeah.
The fact that there are no places to go and dance. I told this to anyone who listened. I want to open a daytime disco where they serve juice, and you have to be 30 years old to get in. You can't be younger than 30 to get in.
Yeah.
A daytime disco. It opens at 11, and then it closes at 9 o'clock. I usually can't stay up past 9 o'clock.
11 a.m. to 9 p.m. Disco that serves just juice, cold pressed.
Yes. Yes.
Cold pressed juice.
Yes, no cell phones in the disco. Dance music. There are lockers where you can put your dry clothes because when you're on, you're going to sweat your tuchus off.
I love this place.
Yes, I love this place.
So wait, can we make one that also allows 54-year-old and 95-year-olds
yes.
in?
No, you can. Anyone is welcome if you're over 30 years old.
Over 30.
Over
okay,
30.
Over 30. Oh, yeah. I love it.
You can't.
Oh, I misunderstood.
You have to be over 30. No cell phones. And I last weekend or weekend before last, I DJed at Sundance. You know, they had our retrospective of our television show, TV show at Sundance. Go figure. They had a panel for that, and then I was the sole juror of a new award called the Next Innovator Award. I watched 10 films and gave the award to – I had to make it a tie. I couldn't – they were two great films. So I had to make it a tie. It was the
nice.
Movies were We the Animals and Night Comes On. Those are the two. Anyway, and the closing ceremony party, I DJed for 2,000 people, and it was fantastic. Dance.
Yeah.
They were all the strippers it was the Holy Trinity that we described, the comic, the straight man, and the dancer, and it was all there.
Oh,
beautiful.
I wish they taught us that in Catholic school, that Holy Trinity.
What are you kidding? That's what it's all about, the Holy Trinity.
They
have a different name for it, but that's what Catholicism is all about.
Yeah, but I had to find the see what I hear when you say I hear you. You were talking about the thing we get angry at, the structure. That's that it's all not real. The structure, the fake structure
right,
of things.
Right.
You know, and I always think it was Bowie that let that crack of light in. And then as I got more into that and punk rock broke, you know, in Philadelphia, we were hearing that stuff as it came out. The Cramps, you know, the Sex Pistols, all these bands, just threw the window open. Yeah. And then I was like, let me out there. And then I got into, like, the Warhol people and I couldn't wait to get to New York to, you know, find all of that.
Yeah.
But it is that early structure that you will do this and you will do that and you will learn this and this is what you wear and that is what, you know. So I love that take on things that you have.
So Norman, for you, was jazz your generation's punk rock, rock and roll? Was jazz and, I don't know, maybe Benny Goodman or if you were 60 in 82.
No, Mike Kellen? My buddy and I, we had a record collection.
Uh-huh.
We all bought the 38 RPMs. What are the big records?
Yeah. Those are
33 and 30. 33 and 30. Yeah. And so, I mean, Benny Goodman, Glenn Miller, the whatchamacallit brothers. We were into that music. Now, that wasn't jazz, but we you know, in high school, we had dances.
Yeah.
The biggest thing this side of sports were those evenings where there was dancing.
Did you dance?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, I love to dance. And speaking of dancing, I'm reminded. When my older girls, and they're now in their late 50s, and one who's 70, when they were young women, 10, 11, 12, 13, and so forth, I used to take them to the theater. We lived in Los Angeles. And I would take them to musicals.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the big hotel downtown?
The Ambassador?
The Ambassador Hotel.
Wow.
Had dinner and dancing.
Mm.
You could have dinner and dance in that with an orchestra, with a live orchestra.
Wow.
So I would take the kids to an early dinner and dance in the theater.
Wow.
And, I love that.
Yeah.
I love it thinking about it now. But it's like that whole way of life is gone.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking it was so much more leisurely.
Yeah.
And would you dress up? And dressing up is gone.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder what that means. I guess historians will be able to tell us at one point why the fact that dancing was sort of extracted from our daily lives, because it is, again, going back to the Holy Trinity, it is the balance of life. You know, you have your structure, which is the straight man. You have your comedy, your comic, who can sort of poke fun at it. And then you have the dancer who actually celebrates the act of life. So the fact that we don't have that Holy Trinity right now is worrisome.
What we have instead is the cell phone.
Right.
You know, family sitting at dinner, five people, three of them on the cell phone.
Yeah.
Which has enabled the current climate to sneak through and the evil game show host to take over the country.
Right, right, right. Well, you know,
apathy.
Isn't the Michael Moore thing? I didn't see his show on Broadway, but someone told me that he said, you know, we don't have to worry about the people who voted for you know who. We need to focus on the people who didn't vote at all.
Yes.
Which is a very interesting shift in consciousness, because I believe the people who didn't vote at all, they were on their cell phones. They were otherwise engaged in not being present.
Yeah, I just saw a thing last night. Billy Eichner and Will Ferrell and the people at Funny or Die they're starting, and a bunch of late night TV hosts like Jimmy Kimmel and stuff. They're starting a thing I can't remember what it was called. It was like, put the glamour into the midterms.
I saw that this morning, too.
Get out the vote for young people, millennials, for the midterms. Mm-hmm. You know, so they're trying to glam up the idea of the midterms, to sexify it.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about how do we, I don't know what to call it, but to build an army. Mm-hmm. Of 10 to 16-year-olds, mm-hmm. or, you know, 10, 12, 13, 14-year-olds, who are saying, what about us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To get out the vote.
Well, that's to
talk to everybody who is, you know, has the opportunity to vote that they don't have because they're too young.
Yeah.
So to get to vote.
Well, yeah, that will be your platform when you come to DragCon, because we're filled with 10 to 16-year-olds. When you come to DragCon on May 11th, 12th, and 13th here in Los Angeles, we'll somehow build a platform for that voice to come through.
You know? Do the podcast from there?
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be fantastic.
Can we get drag?
Yeah, but yeah, I could see.
I'm very pretty.
I could see where you'd be really
beautiful.
What's the name of the 17-year-old...
Yara Shahidi. That's quite a name. Am I saying it correctly? Yara Shahidi? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But, you know, you're right. You're right. The young people are the key to this thing. Because, and I've said this many times, what the enemy doesn't have that we have is our laughter, our music, our dancing, our joy, our colors, our ability to be flexible. They don't have that. That is our secret weapon.
Yeah.
We use the colors, use the music, use the laughter, use our intellect, use the straight man and the comic and the stripper.
Yeah.
Use all that. They don't have that. We have that.
You're so right. They don't have that. They have anger.
Yes. And fear.
Fear and fear. Anger. Yep. That's it. It's it. It's a miserable life. I mean, you know... you know, we hate on them so much, but as Tammy Faye Baker would say, you know, actually, they're more to be pitied than to be scorned, because the truth is, what a miserable life.
Well, yeah, we offer them no leadership.
Right.
There is no great leadership in America today.
Yeah.
Not in corporate America, not in military America. Well, military America, I guess, has it. But not in political America.
How do we make a way or cut a swath for the next great leader? Are they just born or are they nurtured into that position? I mean, you know, you think about Cory Booker. Could Cory Booker get elected to president, you know?
I think it's possible.
So. Yeah.
And last night I was looking at listening to the former attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name?
Eric Holder?
Eric Holder.
Yes, right.
And he was asked, are you thinking about running for president? And his answer was that he would make that decision sometime later. He gave us a date.
Wow.
But he was clearly entertaining the notion.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to him lead up to that, I loved it when I heard that he might entertain the notion.
Yeah.
Because he seems so terrific.
Wow. Well, again, I think us putting this thing you talked about with Funny or Die and sort of pulling together all the young people, making the voting process sexy and entertaining is going to be real key
yeah.
to this this next election.
Make it their thing. Make yeah. it young people's thing. Like, make it really hip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And fun.
Well,
sexy.
It should be young people's thing because the big question for them is, what about us? Mm-hmm. What yeah. are you doing? I mean, you got two clowns who have their fingers on the mm-hmm. on the button that could do away with all of us.
Yeah.
I'm 11 years old. I'm 14 years old.
Yeah.
Help me.
Right.
Yeah.
Get
yeah.
those, rid of those clowns. Clean up your act.
Yeah. But, you know, if they are not present, if they're playing on their phone, how will they know that this is serious business? You know, it's interesting that in our lives that the whole zombie culture phenomenon in the past 10 years, 15, 20 years, really, has become so prevalent. At the same time that people are walking down the streets looking at their phones.
I don't think it's accidental.
I don't think so.
It is purely by design.
Yeah.
And then, like you're talking about Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, but could you find two bigger drag queens? These, I mean, like the hair, she's her with the orange
yeah.
hair and her with whatever that hairdo
yeah.
is in
yeah.
that outfit.
Exactly.
I mean, it's amazing that I think it's all by design.
Yeah. So to answer your question, could you find two bigger drag queens? The answer is no. And I should say, I should preface that by saying two bigger bad drag
bad
queens.
No, evil drag
yes,
queens.
Yes,
exactly. They're the dark side.
Exactly.
We're in the light. There has to be the dark.
Yeah.
And closing with the dark and the two people running our world in the dark, RuPaul, this couldn't have been a lovelier conversation
okay.
for you, or a more interesting conversation for me.
Good.
I will think long and hard about this discussion.
Oh, just good. Great.
It doesn't end with the end of this podcast.
Good.
But you're going to have the last word. This is Norman Lear for All of the Above, and you are hearing RuPaul close this document.
That's right. I'm going to say it the way I always say it. If you can't love yourself, how in the hell are you going to love somebody else? Can I get an amen up in here?
Amen!
Amen!
That's great.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Gitt.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
I'm Spencer Pratt.
And I'm Heidi Pratt with Gunnar Pratt.
The Miracle Baby.
That's
and this
right.
is the hashtag Make Spidey Famous Again podcast.
On podcast one.
We will be discussing the hottest action to ever hit the multiverse. Crystals, espresso, hummingbirds, celebrity gossip.
Parenting.
Of course. Make sure to download new episodes every Wednesday on podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, and make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcast.
And keep your hate on somebody else's podcast review. Thank you.